Welcome to Podland. Podland is sponsored by Buzzsprout, the easiest way to host, promote, and track your podcast there at buzzsprout.com. It's Thursday, January the 21st, 2021. I'm James Cridland, the editor of Pod News here in Australia.
And hello, I'm Sam Sethi, the editor of SoundTalks Technology here in the UK.
And I'm Jamie Ng, CEO of Matchcast, and I will be on later to talk about our new audio and podcast advertising platform.
And I'm Bradley Davis, and I'll be on later to talk about Podchaser and our new funding round.
And I'm Brendan Mulligan from podpage.com, and I'll be talking about podcast websites.
And I'm Sam Crowther, Executive Creative Director at A Million Ads, and I'll be on later to talk about dynamic creative and personalization for digital audio, particularly for podcasts.
They will. Podland is a weekly podcast where Sam and I delve deeper into the week's podcasting news, which I cover daily at podnews.net. You can get involved in Podland, we'd love that. You can send us a voice message to questions@podland.news, or you can tweet us, we're at Podland News.
So this week's big stories, we're going to start off with a story that James wrote about Apple's potential entry into subscription services. James, what's it all about?
Yeah, so there's a bunch of reports started in the Information, and there's a bit more in the Hollywood Reporter about an Apple podcast subscription service. I think that Apple are looking at a subscription service much like they have for Apple Music or Apple TV or various other things where you get exclusive shows. At least I think that's part of what the story is. I think the other part of the story might be, and I rather hope it is, that we as podcasters will be able to charge if we want to for specific shows. So if we wanted to, we could make the next season of Podland available for $2 if we wanted to. That might be a plan. But of course, Apple is saying nothing, as it always does.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think they've got the whole mechanism. So the $99 developer account, if you're an app developer. So I wonder whether they're going to charge a subscription to podcast creators in the same way. So you have to pay so much to have your podcast enabled as a subscription service. That's one way they might tie podcasters into it. Secondly, obviously, they've got all the ways of making those payments to the podcast creators themselves. And thirdly, they can do micropayments. So this would be a no-brainer. I think where it might go, though, is this could kill or try and kill Spotify. That's what one of the reports I read, which is why they bring it out, because Spotify has no micropayment system built within it. And if you put your podcast into Apple, you might want to lock it into Apple and then make it not available on any other platform. And suddenly Apple suck in all of the podcasts that people think they can make money from, and the other podcast platforms may wither on the vine.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that might well happen. And I think, you know, interesting to see also that Apple are apparently testing Apple Music and Apple Podcasts on Microsoft and Windows. Now, that's interesting because the only reason that Apple would be investing in an Apple Podcasts app for Windows would be if they could earn some money out of it. That probably underlines the fact that they are looking at some form of paid-for podcasts. It does also beg the question that Apple Podcasts for Android, they've already got Apple Music for Android, they've already got the Apple TV app for Android as well. Is an Apple Podcasts app for Android coming soon? Who knows?
You talked about the sale of Pocket Casts. Could they have bought and used Pocket Casts?
Yeah, so this is new news since our last Podland. So Pocket Casts, which is quite a decent app. It's on Android first, but also on iOS. It's owned by a consortium of public radio companies in the US, and they've basically said that they've agreed to sell it. My understanding is that WNYC was amazingly bullish about what Pocket Casts could do for the podcast industry, but the person whose bright idea it was then left WNYC, and nobody else really knew what to do with it. And that's my understanding. They seem to be losing an awful lot of money. The company is quite fierce in saying that I'm stupidly wrong by working out that they're losing $2.4 million in a year. But whatever the figure is, they're losing a fair amount of cash. It strikes me that maybe that's a route if Apple wanted to up the game, make their Apple Podcasts app better, and get onto Android as well, then actually reskinning Pocket Casts might be a good plan. It's a much better app than the Apple Podcasts app.
Okay, Apple seem to have been busy this week because they also announced and launched, I think, a service called Apple Podcast Spotlight, which you wrote about.
It's quite interesting move from Apple. If you look at the Apple top 20 podcasts in 2020, which I put on to Pod News a couple of weeks ago, the one thing that you really get out of that is there's lots of public radio in there. There's lots of the big names that you would kind of expect. And those are the shows that Apple are really pushing. Apple Podcast Spotlight appears to be the reverse of that. It appears to be deliberately looking for underrepresented voices, new voices to the podcast world. And it's something that Apple are going to be doing every single month from here on in. You know, an interesting, in many ways, change of tack for Apple to be deliberately promoting underrepresented new voices in the podcasting world.
It just annoys me, though, I have to say, because it means it's another way of having to find the person or people in Apple that you have to go and schmooze in order to get your podcast listed. If I was a PR company and I was working for a podcast, I would just go and find who that person is who's responsible for Spotlight, and I'd be banging on their door constantly.
Yeah, and I'm sure that they have plenty of free lunches, put it that way.
Okay, now, Spotify this week, they had a report out from City Research saying that basically their podcast strategy hasn't worked.
Yeah, so they're an investment bank and or the research arm of an investment bank, and they're quite snooty about Spotify, really. They basically say that Spotify hasn't meant that there have been more app downloads for Spotify. It hasn't meant that there has been more premium subscribers. And then they say the only thing podcasting seems to have influenced is Spotify's valuation. A nice way of basically saying that the only people who care about the podcasting in Spotify is Wall Street and not human beings, which I think is probably a little bit wrong. The client note, which I've seen in full, has lots of graphs and lots of comparisons between Spotify and people like Pandora and, you know, and other companies, you know, as well. But they basically say if you own stock in Spotify, sell it because it's going to be worth less in the future. I wonder whether they're measuring the right things, this particular company, because they're talking about app downloads, which we don't really know because the numbers aren't that public. They're talking about premium subscribers. Well, you don't need to be a premium subscriber. You don't need to give Spotify any money to listen to any of the podcasts which they have. So, of course, it's not going to make a change in terms of that. Where it might make a change is in terms of time spent using Spotify, time spent in app. That's probably the right measure. And I'm not sure that we know whether or not it's been a success, you know, in terms of that yet, because I don't think Spotify have released any information about that. So I'm not sure, but it's interesting at least seeing some of the investment community looking at Spotify and going, well, is it really a success?
Well, I personally think City's wrong, and I think they should be bullish about Spotify, given that the way that I think the industry is going to evolve in terms of ad-supported. It'll be interesting to see if Apple allow you and I to do subscriptions, or is it just going to be the level of Rogan and the extremely exclusive podcasts that will only be allowed to make subscription services? If it's not democratized and the long tail can't participate, then I think, you know, it's not going to have any benefit for all of us.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure that they're barking mad there, Sam, but I think that there's certainly something to be said for having a look at what Spotify are doing and whether or not, you know, investors are getting good value out of that.
Somebody else who's bullish on Spotify is Bradley Davis. He just raised $4 million from Greycroft. And also last week they announced on Podchaser it supports reviews, credits, lists, and more from Spotify exclusives.
Yes, that's right. So Sam talked to Bradley Davis, the CEO and co-founder, and started by asking what Podchaser was.
Podchaser is like an IMDb, but for podcasts. So it's a place, it's a directory where you can go and rate and review things, contribute your credits. So if you've been a host or a guest or a producer or an editor, you can house that all in one place. You can make custom lists and organize all the data around podcasts.
Congratulations, you recently raised $4 million. Well done. Who was that from and what are you going to do with the money?
Yeah, so that was led by Greycroft. and a few other investors. Greycroft was an investor in Wondery, Chartable, Snackable, Fairtonic. They're very bullish on podcasting. So it was led by them. And what we plan to do with the money is really keep doing what we're doing. So making for an incredible experience on the website for both the community, the listeners, but also podcasters, helping to foster that relationship between the two, tied to an archive. So that's our whole thing. We love conversation. We love discussions. We also love data. So we want to make sure that any discussions or comments or ratings or reviews are all tied to that archive. So that can unearth this long tail of podcast episodes to somebody 5 years from now. And then we're also bolstering our Pro Tools. So we released our Pro Tools in October of 2020, which seems like a long time ago, but it wasn't that long ago. And these tools are used for professionals. So brands, agencies, PR firms, publishers are unlocking insights on all of podcasts. So we have data on every single podcast. So we have a lot of plans to make that smarter and better this year.
Excellent. Bradley, thank you so much. Congratulations once again, and good luck with what comes in 2021 for you.
Thank you so much.
Bradley Davis from Podchaser. So Podchaser is one way of having a page about your podcast on the web. Podpage is also a thing. You've had a play with it recently, Sam, haven't you?
Yeah, it's pretty quick, fairly simple to do. You just go in, you give it your RSS feed, it picks it up from your host, and you've got the ability to customize it, colors, look and feel. It does a lot of SEO work in the background. I think they're going to find an interesting market space, because most hosts have underdeveloped a bit where they support you having your own web page with the host. So I think Podpage might be a way of actually upping the game.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I spoke to Brendan Mulligan, who's the CEO. I asked him why a podcast needs a website anyway.
One of the most wonderful things about all these different platforms like Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify is it makes it really, really easy for a podcaster to distribute their content to a large number of people. The caveat is that they're handing over the relationship they have with their listening audience to these platforms. Most people don't have a connection to the actual podcaster. They have a connection to Apple or Google or Spotify. And one of the few ways that a podcaster can very easily form a direct connection is having their own website. People go to Google to search for podcast names. And in most cases, if you don't have a website, the first place people are going to be sent is going to be to one of these players. But if you have your own website and your own domain name, you automatically almost, unless your podcast name is pretty generic, you'll automatically always have the number one spot. Bring people to your website, send them from there to the players, get them to sign up for your mailing list. It's just a really, really important part of the whole process of being able to build an audience that's sustainable over time and an audience that you own.
So looking at Podpage, there's lots of different customization options. You can even use your own font if you use a particular font from Google, as I do, which is really cool. What's wrong with the pages that some podcast hosts give you? Why is Podpage a little bit better than that?
The obvious thing is it depends on the host. There are certain hosts that have actually like really well-designed, really well-structured, incredible pages. There's other hosts that have, I'll just say their pages are lacking. A lot of hosts actually do a wonderful job at being a podcast host and building a great looking website that's really well search engine optimized, customizable. That's not their number one priority. And so it's okay that these hosts don't have amazing websites, but whatever their website platform is what you're stuck with. Again, your miles may vary depending on what your podcast host is, but I think the biggest thing that I haven't seen any podcast host spend any time doing, and I actually don't necessarily think this should be their top priority, is making your website a really great place to interact with listeners. Typically, these podcast host pages are really great, usually attractive ways to show off the content, but you can't interact with the people that are visiting them. And so with Podpage, we want to make it as easy as a website that you have with your host, but full of different ways to interact with the people who are actually visiting to listen to your podcast.
So you have an interesting sort of microphone-looking thing on the bottom of the podpage.com pages. Tell me what that does.
So that is the way for a listener to leave a voicemail. And so what you can do, the way that a lot of people will use it, is at the end of a podcast, they might say, thanks for listening. If you have any feedback, you can go to our website and you can leave a comment or send us an email. Or if you want, leave us a voicemail. Just click the microphone icon. So your listener, your audience will go to your website, click that, and then they can leave you a 2-minute voicemail. It'll be saved in your Podpage account. You can download it. And what we've seen a lot of people do is say like, hey, we'll play the top 10 voicemails on the next episode or something like that. Again, just it's closing this loop where you have this podcasting, you have a one-way interaction, which is you put out a podcast, it gets onto Apple, people listen to it, and there's no way for those people to actually interact back to it very easily. So having them come to your website, leave you a voicemail, playing their voicemail in your podcast, suddenly it starts to build an actual community and an actual interaction with your audience.
How long has PodPage been going, and what are your plans for 2021?
Started developing it around this time last year for a friend that had a decent audience, but hadn't the same kind of thing. He had a personal website, and he used his Simplecast player as sort of the podcast website, but that was it. And so he and I started just chatting about this, and over a couple weekends built the initial version. The official launch was more in sort of the March, April timeframe. That's when we started bringing on external podcasters that I didn't know personally. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's been about 8 months, and it's been great. It's when you build products and businesses like this, it is incredibly arduous and slow at the beginning and then starts picking up. So we're in that phase where a lot of people know about us. You know, when someone asks about websites on Reddit or on a Facebook group, a lot of people will suggest PodPage, which is always, that's a really fun part of the journey. 2021, we just pushed out a massive upgrade to how you edit your podcast website in our dashboard that's been sort of on the list for a long time. And so we're trying to make the websites easier to update. And then we want to start taking sort of the next step in engaging with your listeners and building that relationship. So right now, people submit their email addresses and we connect with MailChimp or AWeber or ConvertKit or any of those for someone who has a big newsletter system already. But there's a lot of podcasters that just want to send episode alerts. And so we might start offering things like when a new episode's posted, we will email your mailing list with just information about the episode and links to go listen to it. Or we'll publish on Twitter or Facebook about the new episode and then publish, you know, 4 hours later and let you set up sort of a schedule of like promoting the new episode. I really, really don't want to go too many steps away from that core, you know, building a great web experience to engage your audience. And so you won't see us ever building, we'll never do podcast hosting, for example. You know, a lot of our users are like, oh, if you can just do that, then I can stop paying Buzzsprout. And we're like, no, you should be paying someone who's very good at that to focus on that.
Yes.
And so,
and especially our excellent sponsor, Buzzsprout.
Oh.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So that's really interesting. And actually just sort of building in more stuff. I noticed Blueberry has been running a little product called Subscribe by Email for a long, long time now. And that seems relatively popular, certainly from PodNews' podcast pages.
Oh, cool.
Well, Brendan, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much.
James, so it looks like you might be a fan of Clubhouse eventually. You've added Clubhouse events to PodNews. What's that all about?
Yes, so pod.events, which is a free events website all about podcasting. I thought, well, maybe I can add links to Clubhouse rooms on there. So if you have a Clubhouse room which talks about podcasting, then do go along to pod.events and submit it and get it in that list. I've been on a few Clubhouse rooms so far, which has been quite interesting. The ones that I take part in are called Podcasts Late at Night, and I'm listening while I have my lunch. So it's a very confused time zone thing, but still, there we are. And you've been having a look a little bit more at Clubhouse as well, haven't you?
Yeah, I'm over it now. I'm over Clubhouse. I created a room this week and then tried to create an event. And strangely, the event is not listed in the room, although they're from the same person. So you then have to send out different messages for people to come to your event when they could be a member of your room, but wouldn't know what events your room's hosting. So I'm sort of frustrated by the fact that this is a product. Most people say it's new. It's actually been out in the States quite a while. And some of the basics are missing. And I just think, I think it's going to be one of those 2 week, 3 week hiatus. You know, when everyone was doing Foursquare, down at South by Southwest, and it got a real big, this is the next big thing. And then now look where, you know, Foursquare's nowhere.
That's fighting talk, Sethi.
It is indeed. I genuinely think Clubhouse has got a lot of problems. And actually this week we had a lady called Claudia Falkinger talk about the good, the bad, and the ugly of Clubhouse. And I tend to agree with her. First of all, she's talking about the good, the networking, the teaching, the collaborating. I don't have any issue with that, but I thought it was more interesting when she talked about the bad, the influencer wave has taken over. Everyone's going, oh, follow me, I'm so special. There's loads of scammers in there selling you courses, how to podcast, what to do to get SEO. And again, there's that fear of missing out. because you can't record anything. So, but the ugly part of Clubhouse is there's a lot of misogyny, harassment. There are hate rooms, she says, for LGBTQ, Muslims, Jews, and black people and women. There are people who have been deplatformed from Facebook and Instagram who are on there now. There's literally neo-Nazis and white supremacists that are very active on Clubhouse, Holocaust revisionists, alt-right conspiracy theories. There's a known sexual predator who's on there promoting Clubhouse with rape jokes. I mean, this is not good. And they're not actually moderating this. There's no way to record it. And I don't even think Clubhouse at this moment is bothered about it. It reminds me of the early days of Twitter. They're more worried about getting more users onto the platform so they can raise more money with VCs. But they're missing out on some of the key fundamentals. And I actually think this is a bigger story about podcasting and audio. You know, if you put up the word Nazi on Facebook or Twitter, they'll track the words that you're looking at and they will flag it. But who's policing podcasting? Or should I say, should podcasting be policed?
Well, that's a interesting conversation to have, isn't it? I mean, if you have a look at what's gone on last week, ProPublica, which is a big website, has been focusing on the fact that Apple Podcasts is being used by people banned from other platforms to reach large audiences, and points at Steve Bannon's podcast, Bannon's War Room. Only yesterday, there was a protest, which to me, from the TV pictures, looked like three different people shouting outside a window. But still, nevertheless, I'm sure it was a protest in a podcast studio in Niagara Falls in New York State in the US. And that's all about allowing white supremacists to use his studio to spread hate speech. The difficulty, I suppose, with all of this is any tool that is used online can be used for good or for bad. And the Americans are particularly fierce about free speech. There's no such thing as free speech on podcasts, of course, because everything is run by a private company. So, you know, there is that. But on the other side, if you start, in inverted commas, censoring people, then that's a difficult thing as well. And I really don't know what the answer is, other than, you know, I suspect that this will be something that runs and runs in terms of the thing that happens when you allow anyone to have a voice is that everyone has a voice.
Well, I've got a plus ça change, plus la même chose. The more things change, the more things they stay the same. My wife used to run MSN UK and they had the chat rooms. And Jill would say that they had the police in there constantly, basically because there was paedophile sharing imagery, there was conversations in those chat rooms. So Microsoft was on the hoof to put moderators in and try and prevent that type of information being shared. And they couldn't. They just could not follow. There was too many chat rooms. There was too many people. And so they closed it down. And I suspect this is going to be a problem for both Twitter Spaces and for Clubhouse. Because if you don't moderate this stuff, all you're doing is creating silos again of hate and misogyny. And that can't be healthy.
I bet they don't have this problem in China.
Well, no, they don't. China seems to be just going along very nicely in the podcasting world. This week, Tencent bought Chinese podcast platform Lazy Audio for 2.7 billion RMB, or $460 million, if you prefer.
$416 million for essentially a Chinese podcast platform. Tencent is essentially, I guess, Spotify in China. And they've bought this podcast platform. Podcast platforms in China are a little bit different because you do charge for some podcasts in China. There is a subscription model. There's also a pay-per-listen model. So, you know, it is a little bit different, but that's a big, big, big purchase.
We caught up with Jamie Ung, the CEO of Matchcast, to ask her thoughts about the acquisition of Lazy Audio by Tencent and how that would help them. But Matchcast also had some big news last week.
So we're actually the first Asia podcast advertising platform. So we're more than just podcast. We rebranded ourselves to be an audio and podcast advertising platform. So the way we do it is by helping podcasters engage with brands directly on our ads platform. So basically our ads marketplace enable them to register for an account and then immediately get ping from brands that are actually looking to advertise on their podcast for native sponsorship. But beyond that, we're also looking at the full spectrum of all things audio, including obviously the dynamic ad insertion, including potentially using streaming ad insertion that's integrated with all the different players. And then last but not least, also working with partners to actually look at potentially audio in different medium, such as maybe gaming platform.
Wow. Now, brands that come to you, what are they looking for? Specific audiences, verticals? What's their pitch to you?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we're definitely not a performance. So think of audio as your traditional medium. So the way we do things is obviously the taking the traditional format, but looking at from a digital way where you can actually account for how many listeners, how many streamers, how many people who download and how many people follow. But on top of that, I think the most important thing is you look at audio landscape itself. It's part of a brand budget. So a lot of the brands that we work with, a lot of the agencies that we work with actually park part of that budget for audio advertising. And they're looking for specifically, and they, I think where we see the trend is they like podcasts because they could craft certain message, which then resonate with either the listeners of that podcast and be able to then immediately see that resonate within the audience itself.
Now, you were talking before we came on air about how podcasting is very different in the East compared to the West. Could you elaborate a bit more on that?
Oh, absolutely. If you look at the landscape itself in Asia, we actually don't have that much data. When you look at the US, there's a lot of data around podcasting, how much everyone's spending. There's even tools for advertiser brands and agencies. There's very little of that happening in Asia. And on top of that, actually, the hosting platform, the service that Asians use may not be very similar to what typically a US or a Europe podcaster would be using. And the other thing is also important is look at the publishing landscape. If you look at China, obviously, there's Liji, there's Himalaya. And if you turn over to Taiwan, there are even new podcast hosting platforms showing up there. And then obviously in India, there's Ghana and then and Jio7. So all of that landscape is very different. So as an Asian podcaster, you know, satisfying and just being connected to all the US podcast player is not sufficient. You actually, in order to grow your landscape, you actually have to be well connected within the Asia listenership. And if you look at that, I think that's very different. I think the other thing that's very different is also just from a concept of how US has audio players and landscape has developed in that you have specific players that play music, which is where Spotify started. And then you have slowly that you have podcast player, and then you have all of this. And then you have Patreon, which is used for basically becoming a patron of the podcast. All of these is independent ecosystem, but they don't really work together. Where else, if you look at the landscape in Asia, Himalaya, obviously in China, has payment, has subscription, has audio books, has even, I was talking to you, having audio drama already on their platform, and then having like comedy, like literally a stand-up comedy on the platform itself. So there's a variety of different entertainment that's within what they call a super app. And obviously sustained by paying for subscription. It's also sustained by having a whole player subscription. So you think about that, it's very different landscape as opposed to what the US and the Europe sort of player landscape is.
Yeah, Apple are allegedly or rumored to be bringing out subscriptions or turning on subscriptions because obviously they can do it for the App Store. So hoping that podcasters now can start to charge for their podcasts. That may make a big difference over here. But Himalaya has been doing this for 12 or 13 years, you were saying. I know last year they made $7 billion. The market is so very different. And that brings me on to a quick story that I wondered what your thoughts were. Tencent recently bought Lazy Audio for $417 million. Are they trying to compete with Himalaya? Is that why they're doing it? What was the acquisition, in your opinion, about?
Oh, absolutely. So for many years, Himalaya is just like the top leader in terms of MAU, which is monthly listeners that's using the app itself. And if you look at where Tencent is, it has been, I would say, the most aggressive in terms of acquisition. It's not just done acquisition within country itself. It's also gone out and bought Riot Games, which is its main game staple. Now it's actually turning its eye into entertainment. I think COVID-19 created a knee-jerk reaction in China, what entertainment is really needed. And interestingly, I was looking at some stats because I know we were going to talk about this, is that a lot of the entertainment within China, even the top movies, I was looking at the last 10 top movies out of China in the last 2020, eight of them are actually China-made production. So that means the Chinese appetite for locally made content is on the high. And what is interesting about the lazy audio acquisition, which in Chinese is called 懒人听书, which means you're a lazy person and you want to listen to a book and you don't want to read a book. That's what you would subscribe to, the app. And
just, that is just me.
Absolutely. I read out to you in chapters. Yeah, absolutely. And it's catering, I think, to a large group of listeners in China who is willing, one, to pay for education, to pay for knowledge. And two, I think the content in itself would give Tencent a really leg up in terms of what its content fulfillment on the app itself. Because at the end of the day, think about these super apps in China. All they're doing is fighting for content. So if you know that there is an appetite for local content, you have to actually find ways to create, which is why I think if you look at the content in China, it's also interesting. It's not just reading of books. It's not just podcasts. It's not traditionally like the interview that I have with you or even drama serial. They actually literally would take like a TV show, adapt it into an audio, which we talk about that some of the in US Netflix is trying, but they're doing that. They literally have an audience for that. And they would do stand-up comedy on the platform itself and people would subscribe to it. So if you think of that content, I would say appetite. So obviously, this is a great acquisition. And to be honest, looking at the price tag, $417 million, that's not the most expensive that Tencent has gone bought into. If it's able to give it that leg up in terms of user acquisition, that monthly paywall, increase in subscriber, I think it's a good acquisition strategy.
Are there any other big players in the Far East? You've mentioned, obviously, Himalaya and Tencent. Who else is worth keeping an eye out for?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think India will have its own ecosystem that will be very strongly and hotly contested. So obviously you have Jio, who is also doing their music app, looking at podcasts, going into that. But the question is, can they extend beyond their own geographical boundaries? Then you have in Taiwan, where we see also podcast companies, hosting companies growing there within that region. And they are also doing something amazing because they have a completely different ecosystem as well. So I think the challenge for the next couple of years is, and we're seeing that, we're seeing all these divergent within this ecosystem. But at the same time, we start seeing also local audiences, local listeners start supporting more local content. So traditionally, if you look at the charts around all of Spotify or even Apple Podcasts, most of the content in the podcast ranking would be, you know, traditionally US-based content, UK-based content. But if you look at it now, you would see some of that top podcasts are actually being produced in-country by the local. So local podcasters talking about things that are relevant to the listeners. And I think that trend is changing because we had heard from brands that would say, look, if I advertise in US podcasts, it goes around the world. Why do I need that? But we take a very different philosophy, the way we look at listeners. So Matchcast does it in a way, what we call as audience influence. So you could have a podcast, but what if your audience influence is actually Taiwan, even though you're producing out of the US? One of the top show in UK, Rise to Meet You, is actually has tremendous audience in Singapore, Malaysia, and Hong Kong. So that would be a prime advertising podcast that I want if I want to reach audience here within Asia. So our methodology from that stretch, how we look at it, is also very different. And I think Asians is going to see from a podcast perspective, I'm going to listen to podcasts that are relevant to me. I don't really care where it's produced as long as it speaks my language.
Which brings me on to my last question. Buzzsprout, who sponsor Podland, have recently integrated with Gaana and Joe in India, and I'm sure they're going to extend out to other platforms in Asia. Is it worth European and American, Australian podcasts registering themselves on those platforms? So as we are on Buzzsprout, I could actually then say, send my RSS feed to Gaana. Are people in the Far East interested in European podcasts or Western podcasts?
Oh, absolutely. I think you will always find a small percentage of audience who's going to be discovering your podcast from that. And looking at the size of India, even if you get like a percent of, say, 40 million listeners on that platform, that is still huge. That's 400,000. That's huge. So if you look at from that perspective, I would say yes. And I think, but then over time, I think it will be an interesting perspective of how podcasts around the region, do they continue to look at just what they're producing for their core listener? Or do they also consider other listeners from other region, then taking into consideration that total landscape? Because If you're a podcaster right now, you're probably monetizing it with a US advertiser. If that advertiser is not present in Asia, that's just wasted space. So again, the question of the region, but definitely from what your perspective is, podcasters should be on those platforms and be discovered. And then over time, learn to understand whether that listener is different and if there's enough of a listener on that platform to actually invest in producing a locally based content for that group of audience.
Jamie Ung from Matchcasts. So you spoke to a man called Sam Crowther, who I first knew when he worked in Leeds for a radio station called Radio Air, which is so good they closed it down. Why were you talking, Sam, to a man called Sam?
Apart from he being a fellow Liverpool fan, he also works for a company called A Million Ads. Now, one of the products that I'm very bullish about is called Descript, and Descript have a service in it called Overdub, and Overdub allows you to synthesize your own voice or a professional voiceover. And then after that, you can use Descript to write out your ad or your podcast, and the voiceover will actually then use your synthesized voice. So A Million Ads is using Descript's Overdub to create more and more ads. But also, they're very bullish as well on Spotify, which we talked about earlier, because A Million Ads uses dynamic ad insertion in real time over IP to get real time data about when you're listening to, where you're listening to, and what the weather might be. So Sam talked to us about how they use A Million Ads with real time data, and also how they're using Overdub to create their A Million Ads.
A Million Ads, the clue is in the title. We are dynamic creative and personalization for digital audio. We've pioneered this technology, which allows it to create huge numbers of audio ads very easily. So that's essentially what it is.
Okay, so how do you do it? What's the process?
Imagine it's creative that's delivered via an IP address. So it's got to be online advertising. And you imagine an audio ad where there are data signals in that return via IP. That means we can change data. So there's different boxes where we have data in terms of the stuff that we can apply to every single campaign. There's data that's specific to different publishers. And then there's third-party stuff, which is a bit more complicated. But the main one, the out-of-the-box, is like the time of day, the day of week, all of the stuff when we know we're serving ads, we can change the creative. So what the system does is it takes the template of an audio ad. Imagine a radio script where it says the music bed and it might have some sound effects and it'll have the different voices coming in. Now, any one of those elements can be changed by data. So for instance, the music bed. So if someone's listening to classical music, then the music bed could be a classical bed and the pop could be pop. So the time of day, the day of week, all of that time-based stuff can be changed. How you're connected to the internet. So the device that you're using, the iOS or Android, if it's a mobile or a laptop, we can identify those. And then from IP address, we can take location if that is passed to us. And then we look up weather, because if we know which city or where you are, we know the weather conditions and the temperature and things like that. And those are the kind of main out of the box.
Now, does this work with both radio and podcasters as well?
Yeah, so this is all digital listening. So it can be any form of ad supported audio in that sense. So it can be a podcast, it can be radio station dynamic ad insertion into those streams via the app and stuff like that, and other audio stuff. And we do video as well, but audio is our heritage and where we started.
Okay, so last year you launched the Studio Podcast. What is that? Tell podcasters how they might use that.
So all of the out-of-the-box stuff that I talked about then we can do, but what podcast specifically is identifying the individual podcast that's being listened to. So that allows us to either, we have had ads that will mention that podcast that's being listened to in some way, and it can reflect that subject matter. So you could, someone like Acast or whatever can put a lot of different subjects together, and we could talk about that and change the lines depending if it's a business series of podcasts, and that could be multiple brands, but it could actually then shout out the FT, whichever the FT one is, and mention that in the creative.
Okay. Talk me through, because you're talking about using DAI, dynamic ad insertion. Is that the critical way of doing this, I guess. You have to be using DAI.
Yeah, that's the thing, because it's a, we can make a decision if it is downloaded or if it's streamed, but streaming allows this sort of live delivery of an ad in that sort of sense. And it also gives flexibility to the back catalogue of podcast inventory that's out there. And because the vast majority of our impressions to date have been like radio stations or Pandora in the US, those sorts of services, the MP3 that has been pre-built in our software that is ready to go, the one that's relative to Tuesday and it's raining outside and I'm in Wiltshire or what have you, those particular lines have been set up for that. When I'm listening to a podcast or what have you, that data could be passed to us and a decision gets made on the correct bit of creative, and that MP3 then goes back in 0.2 of a second and is delivered ready to go in that stream depending on the ad server. So we don't actually serve the ads, but we feed them and ads with people like that.
Now, you mentioned streaming versus download. Do you have a preference? Spotify are pushing very hard because their model is based on streaming. It's better for advertisers. And there's a big contention right now about how you measure the value of a podcast in terms of downloads. There are people out there who are saying, look, that's an irrelevant number. What's more important is actually the time that was listened to of the podcast, because the third ad maybe in a time that's not listened, so downloading doesn't really matter. What's your opinion?
I come from a broadcast background and my whole heritage was Global and Bauer and people like that. And occasionally I'd write an ad and I'd voice it and cast it and get it out there. And occasionally I'd be listening to the brand and then I'd hear it and I'd be like, oh, there's my ad. And you wouldn't get any other feedback because the planning was all done on a Rajard diary that was filled in 3 months ago and that was held by the salespeople. And it was like, you weren't really part of that process. But now we see impressions being delivered live. And because of the type of infrastructure that we have, this is very clean infrastructure. It's radio stations, it's podcasters, it's Spotify. And so the live data, the feedback, and we do a flow diagram in our analytics page. So you can see every single impression that's being served. And if you've written a dynamic script and you've got a load of locations and you've got the weather's really interesting because obviously we've had snow this week in some parts, and you can actually see from the analytics which lines have been and where those impressions have been served that take that into account. And so that to me is really fascinating. But in terms of the creative, I think about my own personal preference. So when I make a decision either to stream or to download, it's purely on my behavior. So I think I'm in London or what have you, I've got to do a commute, I've got to go on the tube, and then I'm getting on a train, I'm going up to Manchester for a meeting. And I consciously think, I want to listen to Adam Buxton or what have you, his latest episode. So I might just go, I'll download that because then I don't have to worry about the streaming. It might be all right on the train, but I'm not sure. So it's easy just to download it and listen to it. And so from a creative perspective, and the conversation that I would have with the clients is, do we, looking at the script, is it relevant that we mention London when it was downloaded, because we might get that information? Is that still relevant to somebody that might listen to it on a train up to Manchester? Yes. Where they download it is relevant to that person's life in that sense. But then it depends on the creative script, what other decisions get made. Obviously, if you're shouting out and saying you're having enjoying breakfast at the moment or something, and it's very kind of conscious use of data, then it might not be so relevant to make that decision. But quite often we write default lines, because if we don't know a location, we've got to have a line that makes sense to somebody wherever they are. And obviously you don't get the data unless it is live streamed. If it's live streamed, you know everything about that person, essentially, where they are, what they're doing, how they were connected to the internet, and how many you serve. The downloads, you're not quite sure when they're listening to it. Is it they're going to listen to it on a train like I just mentioned there? Or is it they downloaded it and they're actually going to do it at the gym in 2 weeks' time? You don't really know.
Exactly. Now, you talk about creating the ads. You're working with a company in the US who is called Descript. Tell us more about what you're doing with Descript.
Yeah, it's fascinating. We, right from the start, we've always used real voices, like voice actors. We give them more work in the sense that now they're doing dynamic script, so they also get paid for the usage on radio. So there's extra money for them. And the way that we build these ads is, if you think about a 30-second ad, it's usually you aim for 85 words max to get it read in a good time in 30 seconds. For a dynamic script, you might have a couple of thousand words. But what we realized coming from the radio industry is that the efficiency of some agencies when they record a 30-second radio ad is pretty poor, in the sense that they, a good voice actor or an actor themselves, they will nail a good read probably, I reckon, on the sixth or seventh take. So they'll get a bit of direction, they'll warm up to the script, they learn it, and then they start delivering it. Now, if you've booked a voice and you paid good money for a decent actor or what have you, then you've got them for an hour. That's the minimum. And what most agencies then do is they just get them to redo it again and again, and they end up going on take six. So it's quite inefficient. And they order, the joke is they order Marmite toast and they have their lunch at a recording studio. So it's a really faffy thing. But when, like me and Steve, who founded the business, he started in XFM, and Simon, who's our head of creative development, was at KISS, and we're all radio people. Now, when you work with a DJ like yourself, you're doing a load of promos or whatever, you don't have that time. You don't have to book them for an hour. So you warm up, you do exactly the same process, they nail it on the fifth or sixth read, and then you're on to the next thing. And that's what we do when we record these sessions, is that we get them warmed up and then we do a list of locations and they rattle through them. And I've never had a voice on mic more than 2 hours. But the difference with Descript, so Descript is synthetic sampling of a voice. So it clones a voice and then recreates, or you can use their own voices. What we're interested in is the cloning part of it. So let's say if you've booked, the example when we had a chat was Kevin Bacon, who represents EE. Now they get, I think, about an hour with him every, whatever, 6 months or something. He gets paid an extraordinary amount. Most of the work they do is on TV, and they get about an hour to do any radio stuff. So even though we've written scripts dynamic for him, he just doesn't have the time to fit it in. Now, if as part of that contract, we could synthetically sample all of his delivery on for the TV, for radio, whatever, and then recreate it, he just then reads the one 30-second script. But then we can actually go through every city in the UK. And because we've recreated that voice and it's agreed that it can be used that way, he doesn't have to sit on a mic for hours and hours. And particularly, so it's an efficiency sort of thing that we're exploring with them. And the test is, as a human being, as a listener, you hear that ad and you can't tell which bits were the ones that were recreated or were ones that were actually recorded live. And the moment you get to that point where you can't tell the difference, you have got this very clever efficiency tool. And when you go to the US, where there's 5,000-6,000 locations for a retailer or what have you, that a voiceover would really struggle to get through in a couple of days, it really makes it much more accessible.
So Descript call that product Overdub, and it's basically you train it with your voice and then they synthetically produce it. Now, that's a bit like the Alan Turing test, is what you're saying, is can you tell that this is a computer or this is a human, which will be amazing. How close do you think, because I've heard multiple overdubs and I'm not a trained audio production person like yourself, how close do you really believe we are to that? Are we there yet, or are we nearly there?
I think it depends on the lines, because the difference with when you hear is any sort of emotion is the tricky thing with a synthetic voice, because there's ways that humans talk where you can instantly know that they're human, and partly because of the little mistakes they do. And as producers, quite often we take out breaths and ums and ahs, and they are very natural parts of conversation. And actually, the way that Google have been experimenting, I've been listening to theirs, and they've added those. So they did a demo for Duplex where they synthetic voice ring up a pizza and order a pizza. And if you hear that recording, when the computer is thinking and processing, they've added the things that humans do, the ums, the ahs, the breaths and all of that sort of stuff. And then it sounds more natural.
Yes, it does.
Exactly. So I think we're getting very close. I wouldn't have them doing a very emotive line. I've talked about demoing up a conversation between a husband and a wife, and the husband's in the car and the wife wants him to go shopping or something like that. Now, that male voice could be synthetic and it could reel out, oh, I'm just going to this store or what have you. Now, if he says that very flat, then I reckon that'd be quite easy. And because you'd process it as if he's in the car, so it would sound slightly different, you might be able to cleverly disguise the fact that the voiceover recorded 50 of those lines, not 5,000. But the female may be getting more animated. I think that would be more tricky to do as a synthetic overdub. But again, we're happy to test it. And the moment that you start putting it through Descript and hearing it, you go, oh, that one's right, that one's wrong. The other thing with locations, which is tricky, is pronunciation. So you'd end up doing a lot of phonetic spelling of stuff. The UK is full of the most bizarre locations. So.
Yeah, get an American to say Leicestershire or Norwich. That's wonderful. So you've rolled this out. What sort of clients are currently using A Million Ads then?
All of the big radio ones have been very loyal right from the start. British Gas, I think, is still probably the biggest radio broadcast advertiser in the UK. So we do a lot with British Gas. We've done a lot with eBay everywhere around the world, in multiple markets. So it's generally the biggest advertisers that are already spending in audio, because it's not a big leap for them to go from, yeah, I buy into radio broadcast and then digital audio makes a lot of sense. And then, oh, this dynamic, this, let's give this a go. So that's the logical sense. So in the US, in the UK, we've worked with big global advertisers, but there's still a place for local and smaller advertisers. And global have been very good with DAX, and Spotify have been good with local, regional, international clients. And then people like Pandora in the US have been pretty good with their sort of regional clients as well. So I think there is a good spread, and I think it's pertinent for all sides of advertiser, really.
So if I'm a podcaster, where do I go? Do I come to you, or do I go to a third party like Global and DAX? How do I, as a podcaster, let's say I've got a decent sized audience, I don't know what decent means right now, but I've got a decent sized audience, how would I engage with a million ads, or do I not engage directly?
From a podcaster perspective, you wouldn't necessarily engage, because your inventory would need to be made available via someone to sell it for you. So a sales house, so an Acast or a Spotify or somebody who would sell that advertising for you, then they can put the details of your audience into their databases. And if it's made available programmatically, then that's the audiences is what the ad agencies are buying now. So they will say, I want people, small business owners who are aged this sort of age or what have you, or in this geographical location. So I just want them in the UK or wherever. And they will make all those decisions. Now, an ad agency will come to us and say, we need some creative to talk to those people. And it might not be the whole creative. Actually, there might just be certain lines that are for the business community. There might be other lines that are for different types of people, or people who home and don't work or what have you. There could be all sorts of different audiences within that. And then the creative can take that all into account.
And last question, you talked about hyper-local in knowing the individual. You gave a great example when we were talking offline yesterday about the fact that you're a biker, but you also happen to be somebody who happens to listen to a certain style of music. Mm. Can you talk us through where that hyper-local would work?
The thing is, right, we talk about dynamic personalization, and those are two different things. There are ads that are dynamic that don't have to be personal. And to explain this, what drives human attention is three things, main things. So the first is personal relevance. Now, Cherry and Broadbent talked about the cocktail party effect. So if you're at a noisy cocktail party, someone mentions Sam, both of us are going to look towards the person. Even though we weren't paying attention, we would get drawn to it. And what that proved was we have selective attention, is that human beings can't take in all the data that's being thrown at them sensorially through a day. So we split and we work out. So that's the kind of premise of that. Now, personal relevance then goes right through. So if that's the top, your name is the top of the pyramid, then underneath that might be that I'm a Liverpool fan. And so, yeah, you are as well. There you go. Two Sams, two Liverpool fans. And we consume maybe Liverpool podcasts or what have you. And that is a very personal thing. And that's unlikely to change in your lifetime. So it's like your name. The music that we listened to when we were younger, when we were teenagers, Stone Roses, I've got a poster up here in my office here, very early gig of the Stone Roses, things like that will take me back to certain times. Now, those are personal things. Now, any of our scripts that take that into account are personalization. They identify who you are, and they have very deep psychological triggers within us. Absolutely. The second thing, so personal relevance, the second is contextual relevance. Now, contextual relevance is different from personal relevance because it changes almost on a minute-by-minute basis. So the context in which we are in, things like the weather isn't personal to me. It's personal to everyone in devices at the moment, or it might be the same weather you have wherever you are. And so that's more contextual relevance. So things that change like that can still be interesting creatively, and they can still be pertinent. I should be taking an umbrella out for the dog walk later or whatever, if it's chucking it down. But that's slightly different from personal relevance. But it's the same thing I talk about, not other than the cocktail party effect. It's like the breakfast traffic report effect, i.e. if you're in the kitchen, you've got the kids all making noise, everyone's having breakfast, and I'm riding on my motorbike up to London for a meeting that day. And then the traffic says the M4 is completely stuffed from Reading. Okay, I was talking to my wife and I would go, did they just say that there were problems on the M4? And I've got a choice. I either go on the M4 or I go on the M3, I go south. And I automatically would go, I'll just head south, I'll go on the M4 and avoid sitting in a queue. And so that is contextual. Now, that's not something that's like personal relevance, but it changes all the time. And so contextual and personal are two separate things. The third thing out of interest is things that are a threat or unexpected. So if you hear a loud bang, that's always going to grab your attention. And then you look to confirm what it is. Sound is brilliant at doing this. And it's also not just the stuff that you pay attention to, but things like birdsong, where you don't pay attention to it. So actually, when birds are singing happily, you know that there's not a predator. So it naturally relaxes human beings. And the moment they stop singing, then you know that there's something up. Or they go into an alarm call and they repeat the same sound, which is then why smoke alarms, things like that, repeat the same sound. So we take in all of this stuff, and that's how we think about what it means to do dynamic personalization, because these are really deep fundamental things that humans have evolved over hundreds of thousands of years. It's only in the modern age where now we talk about low attention orders. I'm sorry, that's absolute nonsense. Attention hasn't been getting less. You can do data to prove it, but you'd say, okay, TikTok, these short little videos that everyone watches. I'm sorry, my kids are addicted to it. They sit on TikTok for hours. You tell me that that's a suppression of attention. I would say that's an algorithm that's absolutely designed to keep you locked in, very focused. And it's the same with podcast. Podcasting is fantastic. I love podcasting. Steve, our founder, said to me, don't run to music, run to podcasts. And I started listening to West Town. And I ended up going for two runs a day because it got so absorbing. I wanted to go for a run to know what was happening next. It's absolutely genius. And so for me, that's podcasting is just on-demand audio, and it's going to come in all shapes and sizes. We're going to get short form. We're going to get long form. We're going to get all this brilliant variety. We've got the big players throwing money at it and doing all of this sort of interesting stuff. But ultimately, it's just good content. It's great content that we love.
Last question. I did say last question before, but this is the last question. Apple have just announced that they're going to start subscription payments. Now, as a podcaster, I've got a fairly sizable audience to my podcast. And that's great because I know that by download numbers. But what I don't know is who they are. And I don't know fundamentally much more about them. I know a little bit about what device. Now, in terms of the personalization you talked about, if I moved the model to a subscription paid model, then I should know their name. I should know their country. So do you think the next stage for podcasting is subscription payments so that we can get that next level of personalization, so that the ad that is listened to in my podcast is, hey Sam, did you know that the Liverpool's game is on tomorrow and you can get tickets right now, as opposed to hello generic person listening to podcast who supports the generic football team, there are tickets to Premier League matches available.
The value, the clues will be if you look at the most valuable companies in the world at the moment, they are data-driven businesses. They're Google, they're Facebook, they're Amazon. And these guys have clocked this 15 years ago, 10, 12 years ago, whenever. And the value in human data is now more valuable than oil. And so if you've got a podcast and you've got access to people, then you should be thinking, I need to know who these people are. And the value is to show, you've got to show the listeners that there's value in that exchange of data. Spotify, will be in their strategy meetings, will be discussing how do we add this value to them so we can get that implicit consent to use this. And to me, it goes right back to Bauer. When I was at Bauer, we bought Absolute Radio, and Absolute Radio was AM music service, terrible, but always done brilliant stuff. Thanks to James Gridland, back to the Virgin days, was that collection of IP data and getting GDPR compliant access to name and gender and age and all those things. And it doesn't mean you have to apply it. You won't want to hear an ad with your name shouting out Sam all the time. So there's conscious use of this data, or there's subconscious use. And actually the longer term stuff is subconscious. But to Bauer, knowing that I'm a biker, that I read MCN, I'm on their database, and that wasn't the same database as the one that I had the login for Absolute Radio and listening through their app. And when I was there, I was saying, that's crazy, because that's what Facebook's all about. They want to know all these little things that we're into, and then they build them at scale. And if you can deliver marmalade lovers worldwide, there's a massive audience that you'd be able to reach through Facebook. And that is the value. So even whatever size your podcast listenership is, knowing some data and exchanging the data for some benefit to them as a listener. And that's the key. When we talk to Spotify and things, the artist management, if you heard a personalized message from your favorite artist, then that might make you go, wow, I understand this trade-off that I've given that data. And I've got my favorite artist delivering and telling me that there's a concert locally and inviting me to it. So that's not necessarily advertising, but it's using that data, but in a more product focused way. And so I'm sure James would be able to say that's exactly what Virgin did and then Absolute have been doing, is to show the benefit to the listener. Then the advertising stuff comes on the back of it. And there's benefit to a listener. For me, if I was listening to Absolute and I was delivered a targeted message from somebody selling like waterproof clothing for motorbike, I'd be like, brilliant. And it's a sale. Get me in there because it's relevant.
Exactly. And an ad is only spam when it's not relevant. When it's relevant, it's actually highly useful.
Yeah, absolutely. And that doesn't mean I don't believe in broadcast to all. There's lots of occasions where I think playing an ad that everybody listens to, that cultural shared experience, is still valuable. If you were launching a brand, that would make a lot of sense. But then there are other occasions where the targeting and the personalization, or just the dynamic ad that sounds different, becomes very valuable. I was doing a lot of painting, obviously, lockdown. And so I listened to a lot of radio and audio painting, and I hear a lot of repetition. Now, the number one thing in my entire career, 20 odd years, that's always come out in research of why people don't like the mediums that I work for, the number one thing in every single one of those years is the repetition of ads. A million ads, the very basic is trying to make better ads just by making them not so repetitive. And that doesn't mean that each ad shouldn't be branded. They should have the same voiceover. They should have the same sonic logo. They should have the same music potentially, but maybe it should be a remix of that melody if I'm listening to classical music in a classical sense, or jazz if you're listening to jazz or what have you. But at least the words in the ad should change, should be slightly different. And when you're doing a lot of painting, you realize which ones actually are really nice because they don't repeat, and the ones that then do repeat just drive you a bit mental.
Yeah. Can you actually show data tangibly? I guess you must do, otherwise you wouldn't have a business, that shows that your ads deliver better return than the standard radio ad. Can you show that the return IP actually delivers some more value?
Yeah, we do a lot of research. Obviously, with the bigger advertisers that come back, it's almost like it's an inbuilt thing. And obviously, a lot of it's sensitive. So we can't make loads of it public because someone like British Gas have made theirs public in the sense that they looked at every single ad that we deliver, and they look at the conversion. So they can identify the same person that was served a personalized ad. And then when they went to the website, they could identify them, and then they followed them right through to conversion. Now, this is boiler cover. It's like the most... it's a pretty dull thing until your boiler breaks and then you wish you had it. And what we have in those ads is all it does, it talks about the weather and it talks about how cold it is, because actually in your head, the colder it becomes, the more of a worry your boiler breaking becomes. So they see this correlation, and the uplift is 2.4 times, just talking about the temperature and the weather, 2.4 times more conversions for those ads than the generic ones that didn't mention it. But then we have other data which shows uplifts of intention and engagement, and they're all around increase of 40, 50% sometimes. But some of the more personalized ones can jump even higher. Sometimes the data is not available to talk about publicly.
Sam Crowther, thank you so much. Can you tell everyone where they find more about your company?
Yeah, of course. Amillionads.com. If you are a creative agency or you just want to trial it out, we give logins so you can engage us. Email me, sam@amillionads.com. We will give you a tour. You can have a play with it. Until you put a campaign live, you can have a practice, have a play, put stuff in. And we actually think longer term, the tool could be used for like short form podcast content. So you could actually do a personalized message. It doesn't have to be an ad. It doesn't have to be 30 seconds. It can be a minute, 2 minutes long. So it could be some sort of messaging that you do to your audience that becomes this sort of personalized messaging. That's a different business model, because obviously the CPM model that we do in the ad world, but it's something that we'd love to explore with podcasters. We'd love to hear your ideas in how you might approach and use the technology in interesting ways. Yeah, ads.com, sam@amillionads.com, and we'd happily help.
Sam Crowther from A Million Ads, such a clever company. And I had Sam talking at a radio conference that I ran called Next Radio a couple of years ago, where he dives into the power of audio. It's well worth having a look at on YouTube. So, Sam, what's coming up in Podland for you later this month?
Well, I have to say, actually, yesterday I interviewed Doc Searles, the author of Clue Train Manifesto and The Intent Economy, as well as Esther Dyson, one of the early investors in Google. And we had a conference chat about Web3 centralization v. decentralization. So if you're interested in hearing that conversation, check me out on Mashup, which is a platform that I use. I'm also interviewing the ex-CTO of Ocado. He built the online shopping platform. He's the technology guy, Paul Clark. And we're going to be talking about generically what's going to happen in the future for online shopping and e-commerce.
Yeah, so Ocado is one of those online grocery services in the UK, which is very clever. I used to use it when I lived in the UK, but I don't anymore. Anyway, I'm doing some planning for Radio Days Asia, which has a podcast session. RadioDaysAsia.com is where to learn more about that. And that's it for this week. If you've enjoyed your trip to Podland, don't make it your last. You can subscribe on all the major podcast players or visit our website at podland.news.
And if you enjoyed this episode, thank you. And please tell your friends by sharing us on your socials. We'd love to have comments from anyone on the show. Send a voice comment to questions@podland.news or send a tweet to @podlandnews.
And the same goes if you want to be a guest as well. We'd love to hear from you. If you'd like daily news, you should get Pod News. It's free at podnews.net. You can ask your smart speaker to play the news from Pod News Podcasting News as well. And that's where you'll find the links for the stories that we've mentioned this week as well. Music is from Ignite Jingles. We use Clean Feed Pro for some of the audio you heard today. I edited Podland on Hindenburg Journalist Pro. Sam edited his interviews on Descript and used Zoom. And we're hosted and sponsored by Buzzsprout.
We'll see you in Podland next week. Keep listening.